Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. In the summer of 1858, Stephen Douglas was the most powerful member of the U.S. Senate. He certainly was the country's leading Democrat, and he was up for re-election that year. His challenger was an obscure one-term member with some success in Illinois as a lawyer. His name was Abraham Lincoln. 1 month into the campaign, Lincoln challenged Douglas to a series of debates. Abraham Lincoln ultimately lost that election, but the debates helped to make him a national figure, and just 2 years later, he was elected president of the United States. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking about how the Lincoln-Douglas debates helped to define America with a noted Lincoln scholar. His name is Alan Gelzo. He's the Henry R. Luce Professor of Civil War Era at Gettysburg College, where he also directs the Civil War Era Studies Program and the Gettysburg Semester. He's the author of a number of books, including a newly published book that's titled Lincoln and Douglas, The Debates That Defined America. It's published by Simon & Schuster and is out now in the bookstore. I'm sure you can find it if you'd like to read it, and it's a good story. Questions, of course, as we move through the hour here, questions are welcome. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. If you would happen to be listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, you can use that. And, of course, if you're listening on the Internet across the country, you can use that number, too. That's 800-222-9455. Here again in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free. 800-222-9455. Any point here, questions are welcome. We just ask people to try to keep their questions brief so we can keep moving along. Professor Gelzo, hello.
Oh, hello.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate
it. Great to be with you.
And maybe just we might remind people just up front here before we get into talking about this, the debates in this campaign, that indeed this was the time in America when the Senate, the U.S. Senate, was not popularly elected. So people in Illinois weren't voting for, were not voting directly for Lincoln or Douglas. At this time, the legislature chose the senators. And so what really they were doing, obviously they were campaigning for themselves, but the goal here was to have either a Republican or a Democratic majority in Springfield, in the legislature, so that then they would choose one or the other guy.
That's right. The way the elections usually were taking place for the United States Senate was for no campaigning really to take place during the campaigning season, to wait for the results of the state legislative elections, and then between the November state legislative elections and when the legislature would convene in January, potential senatorial candidates would then go to work on the newly elected members of the legislature, and they would glad hand, and they would meet behind closed doors, and otherwise they would do a great deal of personal politicking. But even then, it would not be a tremendously public affair. And when the legislature would finally convene after the first of the year, then the vote would take place, a joint vote of House and Senate together in the legislature, and there would be some horse swapping, and there would be some log rolling, and finally, the decision would be made for a United States senator. It wasn't always something that functioned according to strict party lines, because in 1854, a legislature had been elected, and Lincoln advertised himself as a candidate for the Senate seat, which was coming open, and would be voted upon in January of 1855. And he thought he had put together a coalition of dissident Democrats and old-time Illinois Whigs, which would get him to the United States Senate, and he fell just a few votes short of it. And so he did not, in fact, get elected in 1855. Hmm. But that was the kind of senatorial election that took place then.
So this this change, perhaps, into a more popular style of campaigning and something that would be more of a direct appeal to voters, would that be one of the ways that these debates and perhaps this campaign set what would become a precedent?
Absolutely. This is an event. This is the way this campaign unfolds is unlike any other senatorial campaign which had taken place in American history. Because for one thing, Lincoln is, quote-unquote, nominated by the Republican State Convention as early as June of 1858, and they nominate him as the first and only choice of Illinois Republicans for the U.S. Senate. Nominations like that just did not happen, because why should they? No one was going to be voting directly for a U.S. senator during the ensuing campaign anyhow. But for the purposes of the state Republican Party in 1858, they wanted to ensure a united front behind Lincoln. It was not so much because they were trying to make the Senate election a more popular kind of election, as they were trying to make it clear that Lincoln was going to be the only acceptable Republican candidate, and any rivals, and he did have rivals, and any spoilers, and there were spoilers, were simply not going to be welcome, they were not going to be recognized, and anyone who was voting for a state legislator would have to understand that they were, indirectly at the same time, also going to be voting for Abraham Lincoln, because those state legislators, those Republican state legislators, were going to be pledged by the action of the state convention to vote for Lincoln when the new legislature assembled in January of 1859.
Mm-hmm. I suppose something else that's noteworthy about this campaign and also about the debates is the extent to which this became a matter of national news and national interest. And
oh, it really did.
You would think that it would be a little bit surprising, considering that Illinois was on the frontier, essentially. That was the edge of America pretty much at the – not maybe I'm overstating that, but that
– Well, you're not far wrong, because on the other side of the Mississippi, there, as states, there was, what, Iowa, Missouri, mm-hmm. and beyond that, there was the Great Plains and a lot of unorganized territory to the west, which, in fact, turned out to be one of the major issues of this campaign.
Well, that's obviously here the central issue did indeed have to do with slavery and these new territories, the territories into which the country was expanding, and the big question that people were wrestling with, and certainly that the two candidates were talking about wrestling with, was whether or not there would be slavery and where there would be slavery.
Right. Well, I think in the case of this election, it becomes a matter of very widespread national attention. I mean, to the point where, can you think of any other Senate races from 1858 that we talk about today? Well, the answer is
no.
Why this one? Well, the reasons are, there are actually a multiplicity of reasons that riveted national attention on this one otherwise local state election. One is that it involves Stephen A. Douglas. And Douglas, as you said at the opening of the show, Douglas was the most prominent member of the United States Senate. He was the most prominent Democratic politician. He had been talked about for president in 1852. There had been a Douglas movement to nominate him for the presidency in 1856, and people rather generally assumed that he would, in fact, finally capture that nomination in 1860. So 1858 is very important. It's a sort of referendum on Stephen A. Douglas, because, of course, if he doesn't win re-election to his Senate seat in 58, that's going to cook any chances he's got for the presidential nomination in 1860. So you might think of this as the last hurdle he has to get over before coronation time at the Democratic National Convention in 1860. What makes that hurdle much, much, much more difficult for him is that he has broken with the National Party leadership, and the issue he's broken with them over is the admission of Kansas to the Union. Douglas's policy, the policy he had always been promoting as the best national solution for the controversy over slavery, was called popular sovereignty, where you let the people in the territories decide for themselves whether they want to legalize slavery or not. For Douglas, the issue about slavery was not so much about slavery as it was the controversy about slavery. How do we damp down this controversy, get people to go back to their corners, and everybody get along with each other? He broke with the National Party leadership on that. President James Buchanan wanted Kansas admitted as a slave state, and Douglas publicly defied him. So when Douglas goes back to Illinois in the summer of 1858 for his senatorial campaign, he finds that President Buchanan has turned the entire National Party organization against him and is doing his level best to make sure that Stephen A. Douglas is defeated for a re-election to his Senate seat.
Mm-hmm. So he very clearly, Douglas very clearly stakes out this position that says we, he thinks that people in these various places should, they should decide whether they're going to be slave or free. Was it clear, though, as far as Abraham Lincoln was concerned, that he thought that there ought to be, that he was taking a stand against slavery and that it ought to be a matter of national policy, that the, and that there should be one law and that it should cover everybody?
Yes, and I think that you can see this fairly clearly if you think of Douglas's campaign for popular sovereignty as being about, as I said, slavery as a controversy. What he wanted to deal with was not slavery. He didn't regard slavery as the problem. The problem was the controversy that people were making over slavery. That controversy was dividing Congress. It was paralyzing the national government. It was preventing the organization of the Western territories and the opening up of those territories to become states and national development and all those good things. So for Douglas, the problem is the controversy. For Lincoln, the problem is not the controversy. The problem is slavery. Slavery is a moral offense. It is an abomination in a republic that is otherwise supposed to be devoted to liberty. And Lincoln's position is you don't address this by simply treating it as a controversy, and if you put sufficient Band-Aids on it, it goes away. You want to deal not with the controversy. You want to deal with the cause of the controversy, which is slavery. And you want to come to the conclusion that this is wrong. Now, if it's wrong, then you don't encourage its spread into new territories in the West. And that is the dividing line between Lincoln and Douglas in 1858.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Alan Gelzo. He's a Lincoln scholar. He's authored a number of books. And his newest is Lincoln and Douglas, The Debates That Defined America. And they could do indeed concentrate on the Lincoln-Douglas debates that took place in 1858 in regards to their campaign for the seat, for one of the seats in the U.S. Senate from the state of Illinois. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we do have someone here in Rankin on our toll free line. This is line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Don't know how good my signal is, so I'll just make a couple quick points and ring off.
Okay.
Was interested with your guest mentioning about the state legislature electing the U.S. Senate candidate. And I was just curious, a couple of quick questions. When did that change in Illinois? And was that pretty much rules of the case for the rest of the states? I mean, is that how things were around the country then? And then you mentioned about legislatures pledging themselves. I was wondering if there was anything along the lines of today's controversy as to superdelegates. Were they left to their own devices, or were they, once they pledged, were they pretty much beholden to that? And I'll go ahead and listen off. Thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you. It wasn't just the state of Illinois. It was the entire United States where the senators were appointed.
Correct. I mean, that's because it was written into the Constitution that way. The Constitution specified at that time that the House of Representatives is elected directly by the people, but it is the state legislatures which elect United States senators. And that did not change, in fact, until 1912 and another constitutional amendment that made election of U.S. senators direct from the people as election to the House of Representatives was. As for the pledging of the delegates, this is an interesting question, and you know your caller had this right on the money for how much it reminds us of the situation in 2008. Because technically speaking, members of the legislature, I don't like to be technical, but this is technical, members of the legislature were elected as members of the legislature. There was no official obligation on their part to endorse any one particular person who wanted to be elected to the Senate. But the truth of the matter was, if you were running as a Republican for a state legislature, either for the state House or for the state Senate, and you did get elected, bolting from the party could have very unpleasant consequences for you. And in fact, it was understood that there might be a good benefit for Republican state legislator candidates by identifying themselves with Lincoln. So it wasn't simply that Lincoln was waiting for them to like him. They might also need him to get them elected. you might say that they were functioning a lot like delegates and superdelegates in the run-up to the party conventions this year, and with some of the same X factors playing around, because there were people who were suggesting, sometimes rather broadly and maybe a little indiscreetly, that Stephen A. Douglas should be adopted by the Republicans and turned into a Republican candidate. And there were other Republicans who advertised themselves as being interested in the senatorial election, and perhaps they might argue between November and January of 1859 that there was no way that Lincoln could be effectively elected by the legislature, so why not divert the votes to them? There are some things in American politics which just don't seem to change. The issues change, the faces change, and the style of clothing changes, but all the connections of things and the maneuvering of people and delegates and commitments, those things tend to have a kind of aching familiarity when you're looking at both 1858 and 2008.
We have another caller here, someone on the cell phone. We'll get right there on our line 4. Hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Yes, good. Thanks.
So I'm curious, in an era when the only media available were news media, I'm wondering how the debates got popularized, publicized. What were the size of the audience? What was the role of the newspapers versus word of mouth from individuals who were there? And how does that all play with my understanding of newspapers in that era, which were incredibly partisan by today's standards and must have emphasized one viewpoint or the other? And I'm also, because I'm on a cell phone traveling, I'll take my answer off the air.
Great. All right. Thank you for the question. Excellent questions.
I was asked at one point, what role did technology play in the debates of 1858? And this was asked as sort of a joke, because, of course, there couldn't be any technology at all as long ago as 1858. And I had the pleasure of saying, well, no, wait a minute, hold on, there was technology at work. First of all, in Illinois in 1858, there were more than 160 newspapers covering the state. Some of these were weekly sheets in fairly remote areas. But in the big cities, in Chicago, in Springfield, there were as many as 4 and 5 daily newspapers, and they had networks of reporters who were covering events all around the state. You also had, at this point, newspapers which were benefiting from a technological revolution in production. The introduction of double-cylinder, steam-powered printing presses meant that the old-style newspaper, where quite literally some young Benjamin Franklin type had to print every sheet by pulling as hard as he possibly could on a hand printing press. Those days were gone. It was now a much more industrialized and much less expensive way of producing newspapers and distributing them. That distribution, by the way, was aided by the fact that at that time the United States Congress basically allowed newspapers to circulate through the postal system free of charge. So that was another great plus that boosted circulation. Basically, the movement of news was being subsidized and underwritten by the federal government. But on top of that, for the Lincoln-Douglas debates in particular, what the major newspapers behind Lincoln and Douglas did for this, and by the way, your caller was absolutely right about partisanship, these newspapers in the 19th century made no pretense whatsoever of any kind of lofty journalistic objectivity or neutrality. A lot of these papers would, if you read them today, strike you as being a cross between an advertising sheet and a political party newsletter. And they felt no obligation to print all the news that was fit to print. They printed what would promote their particular political party agenda. Editors were prominent figures in the management of political parties, and you could read descriptions of these debates in a Democratic newspaper and a Republican newspaper, and the accounts would be so wide in their divergence that you'd scarcely believe that they were describing the same event. Mm. So the politics did play a large role, but the technology that went along with the politics had a particularly sharper edge for these debates, because the major Democratic and Republican papers, which is to say the Chicago Tribune in Chicago and the Chicago Times, and then in Springfield, the State Journal and the State Register, hired stenographic reporters. They hired people who could take shorthand to go around from debate site to debate site and take down word for word everything that Lincoln and Douglas said. Now, they had a curious system, and again, this brought another piece of technology into play, and that's railroads. Since the debates were all held in major county seats and county capitals, there were rail lines available, and the general process with taking down and then publishing these debates was, halfway through one of the debates, a runner would take the notes, the shorthand notes, being taken down by one of the shorthand reporters, and hightail it to the train station and hop on the train to Chicago. Now, that means he's got half of the debate in shorthand. And while he's on the train going to Chicago, this runner is reducing the shorthand notes to regular reporting, journalistic columns, so that he gets to Chicago and immediately they set the first half of the debate in type. Then the original stenographic reporter, when the debate is over, he hightails it to the station, jumps on the train to Chicago, and begins transcribing the remainder of his debate. He gets to Chicago by that night, and the second half of the debate is then set in type. And then in 24 hours, the entire text of the debate is ready to hit these newspapers, and people can wake up with their breakfast and have Lincoln and Douglas right in front of them. The last technological piece that makes this a national event is that the 1850s saw the creation of the first media networks, and I think particularly here of the Associated Press, which is created at the very end of the 1840s and flourishes into the 1850s. And it was these national networks which also pick up the text of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and so Lincoln and Douglas are being reprinted in the East Coast newspapers as well as in just the Illinois or the Midwestern papers. So technology and media technology come to the aid of Lincoln and Douglas, and for the first time they are making a campaign feel like it's being observed in real time.
Yeah. It was the text also were published in book form.
That's right.
Later, so people could read them that way. And I know if you look around on the internet now, if you have internet access, there's a lot of material relating to these debates, no doubt because of the importance of the issues and of Abraham Lincoln and Douglas. And so not only can you read the text of debates, but you can also read a lot of the newspaper coverage so you can actually see the way that it was reported
That's right.
in the newspapers at the time. And apparently it was the case that depending on the partisan inclinations of the paper, you could read a story on a particular debate where it would say either one of the other candidate wiped the floor with the other guy.
Absolutely.
And it would just depend on whether it was a Democrat paper or a Republican paper.
I'll give you an example of that. In the first debate at Ottawa, Illinois, the newspaper accounts, if they were Democratic newspaper accounts, described the end of the debate in this way. Lincoln had been so thoroughly used up, beaten down by Stephen A. Douglas, that Lincoln had a nervous breakdown at the end of the debate, and he had to be carried off the platform by his disheartened supporters. All right, that's what you read in the Democratic newspaper. In the Republican newspaper, what you read is Lincoln mashed Douglas so thoroughly, so completely, that Lincoln's jubilant Republican followers and helpers stormed the platform, carried him off the platform on their shoulders, and staged a triumphant parade through the streets. That's
that's a pretty big difference.
Are we talking partisanship, or are we talking partisanship? That's making the spin room of modern electoral reporting look very mild indeed.
We are at our midpoint already. We're talking with Alan Galzo. He is the Henry R. Luce Professor of the Civil War Era at Gettysburg College, where he also directs the Civil War Era Studies Program. He's authored a number of books about Abraham Lincoln and about the Civil War. His most recent book is the book that looks at the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and the title is Lincoln and Douglas, The Debates That Defined America. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and you can find it in the bookstore right now. Questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here over in Belgium on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering if your speaker could speak to the kingmaker that actually brought Lincoln to power. A family over in Bloomington, at Biddle, I think the name was. Or am I wrong with that? The person who shepherded him into his national headlines and stuff.
Well, there were a number of people in Bloomington who were interested in getting Lincoln into national prominence. Probably the most famous of them was David Davis.
Davis, yes. Okay.
And his mansion, of course, is there still in Bloomington. David Davis was a major figure in the old Whig Party, had come over to the Republicans, and in fact had been the judge on the 8th Judicial Circuit when Lincoln was a practicing lawyer on the circuit. So Lincoln and Davis went back many years, and Davis was very anxious to see Lincoln succeed. And when Lincoln, in fact, succeeds as President of the United States, Lincoln turns around and rewards Davis by nominating him to the U.S. Supreme Court. So there was a very close connection. But there were also people in Springfield who very badly wanted Lincoln to advance. There were people in Chicago, maybe, in fact, the most critical backers that Lincoln had, at least in terms of strategy, were the circle of Chicago Republicans who are responsible for his nomination and who are chairing the Republican State Central Committee and pretty much calling the tactical calls in from the sidelines for how the campaign is going to be managed.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Certainly, it would have been the practice for candidates at the time to give speeches, and I'm much impressed by the number of miles that both of these men traveled around the state of Illinois and how many speeches they gave. It was a staggering and, I'm sure, exhausting kind of a business. But this kind of event where the candidates both appeared together and you have to admire the stamina of these men, because whoever went first, they would take turns going first. Whoever went first would speak for an hour and a half. Then the other guy got to go for
the opener
hour
was for an hour,
and the next guy goes for 90 minutes, and then
right.
then the first guy got to come back for another half an hour. So
right.
the idea of standing in front of a crowd and speaking for an hour and a half or an hour, to do that over a number of occasions seems to me just remarkable to think of what that would be like. But going back to my earlier question, was it common for candidates to do events like this where they appeared together?
Well, actually, no. They might appear, how shall we say, in the same area code, because there would be a Douglas meeting in one town, then there might be a Lincoln meeting in the same town the next day, or if the Douglas meeting had been in the morning, there might be a Lincoln meeting in the evening. Sometimes these meetings would, how shall we say, coincide. That was when the fist fights usually broke out. There are wonderful stories all through this campaign, and one of the joys of writing this book was to be able to tell these stories. But you would get Douglas coming into town, you pick the town off the map of Illinois, because this happened over and over again. But you'd have Douglas coming into town. He's greeted by his followers, and they carry him either a carriage or in some other conveyance to the public square, and they're having a big meeting, and Lincoln is speaking, or rather Douglas is speaking. And then from the other side of town comes this big noisy parade, and Lincoln is coming to town, and he's got his Lincoln parade and his Lincoln backers, and this noisy brass band at the front of the parade is making as much noise as it possibly can, and it bangs into the Douglas meeting in the center of the town, and the marshals of both of these meetings have a quick, hurried meeting, almost like watching the officials at the beginning of a football game with the toss of the coin, and they're trying to decide, how can we avoid a fight breaking out? And if they're good at this kind of thing, then the parade gets redirected, goes another direction. If they're not too good at it, that's when the name-calling begins. That's when the brass band tries to start playing and drowning out Douglas. That's when the people in the Douglas crowd get angry, and that's when the brawling begins. And, you know, if someone wanted to make a really hysterically funny movie out of American elections, this would really be the opportunity to do it, because it would look just like one of those saloon fights in an old John Wayne Western.
So at the events, then, you would have had a mixed crowd of Douglas supporters and Lincoln supporters, and perhaps people who were undecided and hadn't really declared. Did people behave themselves? Because we were, I think, an earlier caller asked about the size of the crowds. There were significant numbers of people who turned out for these events.
The size of the crowds varied at the debates, the seven debates, from 1,500 at the smallest to as many as 25,000. So you have a lot of people, and in fact, at the towns where the debates took place, you frequently have these descriptions of what things looked like on the day of the debate. You would have miles upon miles, traffic jams of wagons, carriages, people on foot, people on horseback, trailing into town, sending up clouds of dust that obscured the sun. You would have some towns turning this into a minor carnival. There was one of the debate towns, actually the town fathers, set up a barbecue on the town square to provide sandwiches for everybody. And at other places, banners were hung out, and sometimes these banners were not always in what we might think to be the best of taste. If you want a sample of negative campaigning, don't look at 2008. Try 1858, because there was race, there was gender, there was all kinds of strange stuff painted on banners and hung out in public, something there to offend just about everybody's sensibilities. So you have large numbers of people and the potential for a great deal of trouble. The remarkable thing is that in the seven debates, generally people behaved themselves reasonably well. I say reasonably well only because there wasn't some kind of great big gangland shootout at the end. During the debates, even people realizing these are being covered by the newspapers, even so, people would heckle Lincoln or Douglas. They would throw things. There was one occasion in which someone shied a melon at Douglas, hit him on the shoulder and bounced off. And Douglas, for his part, Douglas being a very combative person, Douglas would turn around and bait the crowds. And he would shake his fist at them, and he would call them names. He would dare them to come up on the platform. He would dare them to say this. Aha, he says, I've got you. The shoe is pinching you. You know that I've got Lincoln where I want him. And it goes on like that. And sometimes you have a very dignified United States senator, and sometimes you have this down-in-the-gutter politician. And this is going on all through these debates. But at least at the debate sites, that's reasonable behavior. It's when you get out into the hinterlands, in the individual locations where Douglas or Lincoln might be speaking just on their own or a whistle stop as they're blowing through town, that's when people really start behaving in some very snarky ways. And that's when you do get the fist fights. And in fact, two candidates for the state legislature who decided to imitate Lincoln and Douglas and stage a debate of their own, that, in fact, degenerated into shoving on the platform, and finally one of the candidates punched the other and knocked him off the platform. The wonder is that Lincoln and Douglas didn't get quite down to that, but other people did. So it's a cross between high politics and P.T. Barnum that's going on all through this 1858 campaign, and the images of it from town to town and place to place. If the issues weren't so serious, they would almost be a comedy.
Let's talk with some other people. We'll go to Urbana for another caller here. Line one. Hello.
Oh, good morning. One issue which was left out of the debate was white racial superiority. That was assumed, I take it. And the real controversy, from what I've read, is that is over the expansion of slavery into territories created out of the Louisiana Purchase, where Lincoln opposed it according to the ordinance of 1787, and Douglas said, hey, let the people choose what they want. And oh, by the way, didn't Douglas have a cannon that he dragged around with him and set off?
Yes, he did.
Okay, I'll listen to more. Thank you.
That cannon was nicknamed Little Doug. And it was part of Douglas's promotional strategy, because he had friends with the Illinois Central Railroad. They provided him with the use of the director's car, and he had hired a locomotive, this car, and a flatbed car, on which he mounted a little brass cannon, a little brass howitzer, and he had two men dressed up as artillerymen, and when he would approach a town on his train, his train's coming into town, they would set off the cannon to let everybody know that Stephen A. Douglas was coming into town. So that little brass, we don't know what happened to that little brass cannon. I'd love to find out. It's bound to be stored somewhere in somebody's barn or maybe somebody's attic somewhere. But if anyone listens to this program and they've got this unexplained little three-pounder brass howitzer sitting around, please let somebody know about it, because it might turn out to be the original Little Doug, and it really, would really be fun to find that. As far as the issue, though, your caller puts his finger on one of the rawest points of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Here's where you move from the low comedy of the debates to the high issues. Because, strictly speaking, white supremacy, even though it wasn't discussed as white supremacy, was always the background of these debates. When people talked about slavery, when Lincoln and Douglas talked about slavery and expansion into the territories, they always had to do it against this understood background that almost everyone they were talking to in Illinois, who was a white person, was also a racist of the deepest dye. This was simply the kind of thing that was in the air, and it didn't smell very nice, but like living next to a municipal authority, it was in the air, and you breathed it. Lincoln began his campaign in July of 1858 with a speech in Chicago, which wanted to clear the ground of white supremacy and race issues. He wanted to concentrate on slavery itself, and so he said at Chicago, "We need to stop talking about this man's race or that man's race. We need to stop talking about whether this man is equal to that man or the other man. We've got to start talking about the justice and immorality of slavery itself." Now, Douglas jumped onto that at once. And from that moment, the 10th of July, all the way until the end of the campaign, Douglas does nothing but play the most vile form of the race card. Lincoln is promoting black equality. Lincoln is promoting miscegenation. He's promoting sex between blacks and whites. And he does this in a fashion that would make a Ku Klux Klansman blush with shame. I mean, Douglas uses the race card in the most revoltingly demagogic fashion, because he's appealing to this prevailing white supremacy ideology in Illinois in the 1850s. I mean, Illinois was a free state, but it was free not only of slavery, it was also, for the most part, free of black people. There were black people in Illinois, but Illinois had statutes on the books that forbade the immigration of blacks into Illinois. So while Illinois might have been opposed to slavery, it was also opposed to black people. And the lives of black people in Illinois were not happy ones, because if you were black in Illinois, you had to pay taxes, but you couldn't send your children to school. You were liable to civil suits, but you couldn't legally testify in court, much less vote. So Douglas uses this as a stick that he's whamming over Lincoln's head. Lincoln is going to promote his opposition to slavery is just a stalking horse. Don't believe it. The real issue is Lincoln is promoting black equality, black sex, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Lincoln finally has to turn on this, and he does it in probably the most unwise fashion. He's under a lot of pressure from the State Central Committee. He's under a lot of pressure from his own backers, who are begging him, you know, you're going to have to say something that is going to deflate Douglas. And at the debate at Charleston, Illinois, in September, Lincoln gets up and makes an off-the-cuff remark about how he is not in favor of black political or social equality. These are words that have haunted Lincoln ever since. They're the words that everyone who loves Lincoln wishes he'd never said, and they stand as little more than a flat contradiction of what he had said at the beginning of the campaign in July. And the reason he says it, well, there's some technical reasons, but I think the fundamental reason is he was just under so much pressure, to put distance between himself and the kind of racial demagoguery that Douglas was promoting, that he allowed himself to be persuaded to say, while I'm opposed to slavery, while I want freedom and natural rights for black people, I'm not talking about civil rights, I'm not talking about social interaction. But then, of course, he turns around and says right away, but in the right that any black person has to eat the bread that they grow by the sweat of their own brow, then that person is my equal, Judge Douglas is equal, and the equal of every living man. Now, that's a radical statement in Illinois in 1858. It doesn't strike us today as being exactly a ringing endorsement of racial equality, and literally speaking, it wasn't. But Lincoln here is being pinned by Douglas. I wish, I mean, if Abraham Lincoln had asked me for advice, I would have told him, just go for it. You know, don't pander. Don't make concessions to Douglas. But Lincoln's a politician. He's trying to win an election, and so he makes this fatal concession. And it's one I think we've been busy trying to apologize on Lincoln's behalf for ever since. I wish he'd never said it. He did, but that measures the power, the unquestioned power of white supremacist ideology in Illinois and across the United States in the middle of the 19th century.
We have just about 5 minutes left. Our guest is historian Alan Gelzo. He's the author of a new book about the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which is titled Lincoln and Douglas, the debates that defined America. We have another caller to talk with, and we'll do that. And this listener is in Urbana and on our line number two. Hello.
Hello. I have two questions. First, how closely was this followed by the European press? And secondly, how important were the German expatriates, the 48ers?
Well, the European press doesn't show much sign that it noticed anything that was going on in a senatorial election. Only one foreign reporter had very much to say about this. That was Harriet Martineau, and at that point it's not clear that Harriet Martineau still regards herself as being an English woman, because she has lived in the United States and is doing journalism in the United States for so long. And when she talks about the Lincoln-Douglas race, she doesn't even talk about Lincoln. She talks about Douglas, because Douglas is by far the more famous, and people far removed from Illinois were very likely to regard the Lincoln-Douglas contest as a referendum on Stephen A. Douglas more than an equal match between Lincoln and Douglas. But as far as the way the German vote went, the German vote was an important swing vote. The Germans of Illinois had a strong bias against slavery and did not wish to see slavery legalized in the territories. Many of them were refugees from the liberal revolutions in Germany in 1848. So they came with sympathies, they came to America as refugees with sympathies on the side of liberty. At the same time, though, and here was the problem for Lincoln, Lincoln's party, the Republicans, was largely an outgrowth of the old Whig Party, which had gone to pieces in 1856. Lincoln joined the Republicans in 1856. Many other Whigs did, and in fact a large portion of the Illinois Whigs became Republicans, like David Davis, whom I'd mentioned before. The Whig Party had an unhappy reputation for nativism, for hostility to immigrants, and a lot of German immigrants had not forgotten that. The Whigs also had a strong New England component, and these New Englanders, as children of the Puritans, were in favor of temperance, and that cut against the grain of Germans who liked their glass and liked their beer gardens. So it was a toss of the coin as to whether Douglas was going to win the Germans, because the Germans didn't particularly like the culture of the Republicans, or whether the Republicans would win the Germans, because, well, the Republicans were the party that was standing against slavery. This came to a point for Lincoln on one occasion when one of Lincoln's political allies, Joseph Gillespie, was going to be taking Lincoln to a meeting in Highland, Illinois, which was an almost entirely German community. Even the newspaper was published in German. And on the way, Gillespie said to Lincoln, well, you know, we're going to have this meeting with these Germans, and you know, you're going to have to drink beer with them. Well, Lincoln, who was a teetotaler, said, I can't do that. And Gillespie immediately saw a disaster. So what Gillespie did was to invent this cock and bull story that Lincoln had an illness, which meant that he couldn't drink alcohol at that moment. And with that in hand, Lincoln and Gillespie went to Highland and met with the Germans, and Gillespie said, and everybody had a good time. I'm not entirely sure how they had that good time, but that was the way that the German vote had to be appealed to.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, the German vote probably was more sympathetic to Lincoln than to Douglas and some of the most important German leaders in the Midwest at that point. Karl Schurz, Gustav Kerner, all were campaigning for Lincoln.
We're coming down to the point here where we have maybe about 2-3 minutes left, and I want to talk about the ultimate outcome of the debate. Douglas held on to the seat in the Senate because the Democrats, they got control of the legislature. They were in the majority, so they got to choose. So Lincoln didn't win, and he was apparently quite despondent about it afterwards. But interestingly enough, the way that it worked out ultimately was that because this got national coverage, it helped to make Lincoln now a national figure, and also because Lincoln managed to back sort of Douglas in a corner and expose the contradictions of his embrace on the one hand of the Dred Scott decision and the other, this idea of popular sovereignty, Douglas was really crippled as a result of the what he said and the attention that it got, and ultimately it damaged him.
Oh, it did. It's funny to watch how over the course of these seven debates, the center of discussion moves from a question about policy. That was what Douglas wanted to talk about. What's the policy we should adopt about slavery? Lincoln, over the course of the debates, changes the center of the discussion to a question of the morality, the right and wrong of slavery. That you have to make a decision. Is slavery something right? Is slavery something which is immoral? And once you've arrived at that decision, that then will tell you what you ought to do about policy. That is why I say that these are debates that define America, because Lincoln insists that the American democracy is about more than just process and referendums and 51% of the majority. Rather, the American democracy is about choosing what is right, doing the right thing. And Lincoln really moves the center of the discussion by the end of the debates to that point. He loses the election. Now, he loses. He actually won. If we count the votes and the noses, he would have won a popular election. But because of the apportionment in the legislature, Douglas wins the election. But it is his arguments. It is the power of Lincoln's arguments in the debates about the morality and the moral question of slavery which win him a national audience. And people who began reading these debates in the newspapers because they were about Douglas end reading these debates because they want to hear what Lincoln has to say about slavery. And it's that that paves the road toward 1860 and Lincoln's election to the presidency.
Mm-hmm. Douglas himself, I think that he only lived a couple of years after this.
That's right. He was reelected to the Senate in 1859. Then he runs for president. He is nominated for the presidency. And his opponent, curiously enough, turns out, again, to be Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
He loses that election and dies in June of 1861, just after the outbreak of the Civil War. Probably, we don't have an exact description of cause of death, but I think it's partly a case of possibility of a minor stroke, heart trouble, and just having worn himself out completely with the previous 3 years of politicking.
Yeah. That just, I guess it goes back to my thoughts about just how physically demanding, and I'm sure running for office today, a senator for a presidency,
yeah,
physically demanding, but how physically demanding this would have been, the kind of schedule that they kept up, how much they traveled, how many appearances they made, how much speaking they did. It must indeed have been exhausting.
It was, and Lincoln, of course, Lincoln was very strong physically. Lincoln went through the whole campaign like the Energizer Bunny. By the time he came to the end of the debates and the end of the campaign, he is still going strong. Douglas, however, even though Douglas was called the little giant and described as a steam engine in breeches, had actually suffered from ill health most of his life. And halfway through this campaign, Douglas is clearly giving out, and he's trying to cope with the giving out by drinking. And by the end of the debates and the end of the campaign, Douglas has got himself a first-class alcohol problem that is showing. He's unsteady on the platform. His pronunciation has become thick and mushy. He's come down with a cold, which develops into bronchitis, which means he drinks more. The campaign was really, really brutal on Douglas. Lincoln takes 2 weeks off after the campaign and then is back in his office handling legal business.
Well, it's a good story, well told, and I would recommend it to folks. The book is Lincoln and Douglas, The Debates That Defined America. It's published by Simon & Schuster, by our guest Alan Gelzo. His last name, by the way, spelled G-U-E-L-Z-O. He's Henry Luce Professor of the Civil War Era at Gettysburg College, where he directs the Civil War Era Studies Program. Professor Gelzo, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
The broadcast today is made possible with support from these business partners: Billy Beruse in Champaign, Inuka Incorporated in Fairmount, Illini Studio in Champaign, Risk Management Commodities in Lafayette, and REMAX Realty Associates in Champaign. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. And thank you. Coming up a little bit later today, Celeste Quinn will be talking about the man who created Roget's Thesaurus. He began making lists, organizing the English language, when he was just 8. Next time on the program on the Afternoon Magazine, a conversation about Peter Mark Roget. The guest will be journalist Joshua Kendall, who's authored the book The Man Who Made Lists, Love, Death, Madness, and the Creation of Roget's Thesaurus. That's coming up in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Today, Celeste Quinn is the host. The program gets underway at noon here on AM 580. In the next hour of this show, we'll be talking about No Child Left Behind, about school accountability and performance. And our guest is Lizanne DeStefano. She is Executive Associate Dean for Research and Administration in the College of Education here at the U of I. So that's just in a little bit. First, though, we'll take a break, as we usually do, for news and an update on the markets. So please stay tuned.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Lernard Seed Service, an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products to farmers in East Central Illinois. Lernard Seed Service provides customer services and agronomic information to help customers maximize profits. Lernard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where prices are under severe pressure to the downside today. Let's go right to the screen. March wheat in Kansas City now trading at 12.85, down 10. July 12.13, down 53. At the Chicago Board of Trade, March wheat 11.94, down 40. May 11.72, now 11.71 and a half, down 72 and a half. July 11.39 and a half, down 74. March corn 5.41, down 18 and three quarters. May 5.54 and a half, down 15. July 5.67 and a quarter, down 14 and a quarter. September 5.77, down 6. December 5.70, down 13 and a quarter. March beans 13.40, down 47. May 13.54 and a quarter, down 48 and a half. Now 48 and a quarter. July 13.69 and a half, down 49 and a quarter. November 12.80.